May it please the court. My name is Gary Crawford, and I represent Rocio Ojeda de Toca, the petitioner in this case before the court.
Now, let me ask you a question. Would that be Mrs. Ojeda, Mrs. Toca, or Mrs. de Toca?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that it is Mrs. Toca is how she goes by when she's in the United States. I'm not certain how she goes when she's at home in Mexico City. Mr. Bailey and I will divide our time equally in opening, and then I will argue in rebuttal, and also, with the court's permission, Mr. James Renard, who has filed an amicus brief, will also argue in rebuttal today as an amicus curiae. I will discuss the facts of the case and discuss the law generally.
I don't have any objection to it, but normally when someone wants to argue as an amicus, they ask the court's permission to do so, to share the time with the parties themselves. I don't have a problem with it, but that's a better procedure.
It's my understanding that that permission was requested ahead of time and had been granted by the court.
Okay. Thank you, pardon.
Mr. Bailey will discuss in detail the four cases which the 14th Court of Appeal stated as the basis for its decision that the recording statute was a complete bar to an action for fraud under the DTPA and the statutory real estate fraud case. Those four cases are Medallion Homes versus Thermar Investments, Jernigan versus Page, Westland Oil versus Gulf Oil, and NRC versus Pickard. Mr. Bailey will distinguish those cases or discuss our contentions that those cases are wrongly decided and should not be extended to the holding in this case. The facts of this case are that Mrs. Toca was a resident of Mexico City and that she and her husband were coming to the city of Houston regularly several years ago to visit the medical center there for treatment for Mr. Toca's mother. In order to avoid having to stay in hotels and also for the purpose of making an investment in the United States, Mr. and Mrs. Toca decided that they would purchase real estate in Houston in the name of Mrs. Toca, that they would have this as a United States investment, and also that they would have this house to live in on the occasions when they came to Houston for a month or 6 weeks stay while Mr. Toca's mother was being treated at the medical center. They located a house adjacent to the medical center in Houston, which had been damaged by a fire and had been abandoned and left to the elements for some time and was in a damaged condition. This house was owned by Wise Developments, a corporation which was wholly owned by William J. Wise, the other defendant in this case. Mr. Toca was in the building business and felt, although the house was in a damaged condition and had been burned and had been left open to the elements, that because of his expertise in the construction trade, that he could economically restore the house to a livable condition and it would be a good investment. Unbeknownst to the Tocas, however, the city of Houston, pursuant to its authority, had previously entered an order which stated that the house had been determined to be a dangerous building and that if it were not brought into compliance with the codes and repaired within a particular period of time, the building would be torn down by the city and the cost of the demolition would be assessed as a lien against the property. The jury found, based on testimony and evidence which we think was clearly sufficient, that William J. Wise and Wise Developments was aware of this order at the time that he sold the property to Mrs. Toca. However, Mr. Wise wholly failed to disclose this City of Houston demolition order and the effect of it to Mrs. Toca prior to closing. Mrs. Toca arranged for the purchase of an title insurance policy from the companies that were co-defendants at trial. Title policy was issued to her, which also wholly failed to make any mention whatsoever to the order of the City of Houston building official. Mr. and Ms. Toca returned to Mexico City, stayed there until the following summer when their children went out of school, returned to Houston to begin repairs on the house, to prepare to move into the house, and discovered that the house had been completely demolished and all that was left was the garage that they had parked their car in. Upon investigation, they learned that the city of Houston had done this and that it was pursuant to an order of the building official which had been entered prior to the time that they had even purchased the property from Mr. Wise. This suit was then brought on several theories, including claims that the defendants Wise and Wise Development Company had violated Section 1746B23 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and had violated Section 27001 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code, what's commonly referred to as the fraud in a real estate statute. The basis of the claims were that Wise had a duty to tell Mrs. Toka of the order of the building official that the house was about would be torn down or was subject to being torn down at any time and a lien placed against it, and that had it not been for his failure to so tell them, Mrs. Toka would not have purchased the property. The plaintiff obtained jury findings consistent with their position on that case in the trial of the case, and judgment was entered in their favor. However, upon the appeal to the Court of Appeals held that the recording statute, Section 1301 of the Property Code of Texas, was a complete bar to Mrs. Toka's causes of action under the DTPA and under Section 2701 because they were held to have constructive notice of the order of the building official because it had been recorded in the official public records of real property, and that therefore Mrs. Toka could recover nothing whatsoever, and the 14th Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's judgment. The purpose of the recording statute,
Captain, before you move on and finish your recitation of the facts, would you clear up something for me? The tokens have been paid by the title company. When did that occur and what amount?
That occurred, Your Honor, after we had filed this application for writ of error because we had alleged 4 points of error, alleging that the Court of Appeals had also erred in making its decision. We obtained a negligence finding against the title company. We did not obtain findings on DTPA or statutory fraud against the title company, but we did obtain negligence findings, and the court also entered judgment against the title companies based upon negligence. The Court of Appeals also reversed that portion of the judgment. After we had filed our application for writ of error to this court, negotiations were begun between the title companies and Mrs. Toka, and a settlement was reached whereby we dismissed the application for the writ of error with regard to the title companies, and they paid us a total of $22,000, which is approximately half of the amount of the judgment, considering pre-judgment and post-judgment interest. There remains approximately half of the amount of the trial court's judgment, which has not been paid by settlement.
What was the amount of the title policy?
Approximately $22,000, I believe.
How would that settlement impact if we were to reverse the Court of Appeals and rule with you against Wise? How would that settlement impact upon any judgment you might have against Wise?
I think Wise would receive credit for payment of that portion of the judgment, and we could recover only the excess amount of the judgment after deducting the $22,000 that we received in settlement from the Houston Title and Title Insurance Company of Minnesota. I do not think it would be in any way a bar to the judgment against Wise, that only he would get the benefit of that payment.
What were your actual damages? Tell us about the judgment. Yeah.
Okay. The jury found the difference in the value of the property as represented and in its actual condition to be approximately $19,000. In addition to that, another item of damages was the amount of the lien that the city of Houston had placed against the property, which was approximately $1,700.
And that was demolition costs?
Yes.
And the rest of the judgment was?
Attorney's fees and pre-judgment, post-judgment interest.
There were no exemplary damages awarded?
Yes, there were also exemplary damages against the Wise and Wise Development Company.
Was it DTPA trebled or?
It was exemplary damages under Section 27001 and also exemplary damages under the DTPA.
Are you claiming you're entitled to both of those elements here?
Yes. I think it's important to begin by looking at the purpose of the recording statute. As stated in the Restatement of Torts, the purpose of the recording statute is to offer notice to subsequent purchasers of property of any other conveyance or encumbrance against that property. As the Restatement of Torts expressly states, that the purpose of the recording statutes is not to provide protection for, and the terms that the Restatement of Torts uses is fraudulent liars. And this has been recognized to be the law in Texas in the case of Boucher versus Wallace, which is a 1951 Eastland Court of Appeals decision in which the writ was refused as no reversible error. The court stated expressly there that the purpose of the recording statute was not give protection to perpetrators of fraud. And that is exactly what the opinion of the 14th Court of Appeals has done. Rather, the court held there that the purpose of the recording statute was simply to notify subsequent purchasers of outstanding encumbrances and conveyances. And in that case, the court specifically stated that a buyer of real estate was under no duty to examine the deed records to determine whether his seller was defrauding him. So the very purpose of the recording statute is turned around by the decision of the Court of Appeals from being a shield to being used as a sword by those who have perpetrated fraud. And that is the effect of the decision of the Court of Appeals to allow Wise and Wise Developments to use that statute as a sword against Mrs. Toca. We think the court was clearly incorrect in that. Indeed, even at common law, constructive notice provided by the recording statute was not a defense to an action for fraud. This court recognized that as early as a 1909 decision in Buchanan, I believe it's Buchanan versus Barnett, a case in which, again, a purchaser of real estate sued the seller for fraud. The allegation was made that the seller was on notice of his lack of good title because of the instruments were of record, and as early as 1909, this very court failed to accept that argument. So even at common law, the constructive notice is not a defense to an action for fraud, and certainly under the deceptive trade practices, it should not be. This court, by its decision today in Alvarado versus Bolton, has once again recognized, just as it did in Smith versus Baldwin, that the purpose of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act was to provide a remedy for consumers without the numerous defenses encountered in a common law action. So certainly it would be improper to provide a defense through constructive notice to a DTPA action, which would not even be a defense to an action for fraud, for common law fraud. And that is the effect of the 14th Court's decision as well. Indeed, the overwhelming authority throughout the United States is that the constructive notice that is provided by a recording statute is not a defense to an action for fraud. In the briefs which have been filed, I think there are citations from 12 different states that hold exactly that. Our research fails to find any authority of any state other than the 14th Court's decision and the Jernigan and Medallion Homes opinions from the state of Texas that would allow the constructive notice statute to become a defense for an action of fraud, whether that is common law fraud, statutory fraud, or misrepresentation under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, such as we have in Texas. So I think clearly the Court of Appeals erred in its holding that the recording statute provided constructive notice and that constructive notice was a complete bar to the cause of action for fraud, whether that be based on the Deceptive Trade Practices or whether it be based on Section 2701. with regard to the Alvarado versus Bolton decision that the court had just issued its opinion on rehearing today. With regard to the dissent notices that this is an action for breach of warranty, and that what Alvarado was doing in that case was using the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to create the very warranty that he was suing for breach of, and that was not the purpose of the DTPA. But our case is not that. It is a case for violation of 1746B23, the misrepresentation provision. Thank you. Tell
me again now how you got both exemplary damages and treble damages.
We did not get treble damages. The jury found that the additional damages under the Act amounted to $2,000. And they found the exemplary damages under Section 2701 to be $5,000.
But the conduct which underlay both of those awards was identical.
That is correct.
Do you think you're entitled to both the $2,000 and the $5,000 if they're based on the same conduct?
I think we are because they violated two separate statutes. But if the court should disagree and we have to make some type of election, then I think we would be entitled to choose that remedy which provided us the greatest relief.
Did they have any point of error in the Court of Appeals complaining of the $2,000 and $5,000?
No, they did not, to my recollection.
So $2,000 was DTPA and $5,000 2701
damage? Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you, Jim.
May it please the court, I'm Darrell Bailey, and I'm going to discuss the cases which the 14th Court of Appeals held barred Mrs. Toka's claim under the DTPA and under statutory fraud. I'm additionally going to discuss the Spies-Robert versus Opperman decision, which was a recently writ denied case, and that case was reported in October 1987 and thus was not in the petitioner's application for writ of error, in that the petitioner's application for writ of error was submitted to this court in August of 1987.
You know that is still on rehearing, Spies-Roberts versus Overman, rehearing in front of this court.
I see. The first case of Jernigan versus Page, which held that constructive notice was a complete defense to a DTPA cause of action, was, first of all, it needs to be pointed out that the trial court in that case directed a verdict against the counterclaim of the Jernigans. The Jernigans were the defendants of the trial court. They were counterclaiming under the DTPA, and the trial court directed a verdict upon a no evidence issue. Therefore, the discussion by the Court of Appeals of a defense to a DTPA cause of action was simply inappropriate, because why would you discuss a defense to a DTPA cause of action when there was no DTPA cause of action found at the trial court level anyway? In discussing that defense, the Court of Appeals said that they did not believe that there was anything in the DTPA which would indicate that the legislature did not intend the Recording Act to be a defense to a DTPA cause of action. I submit to the court that the more appropriate statement in that context would be, there is nothing to indicate that the legislature intended the Recording Act to be a bar to a DTPA cause of action. The reasoning behind that is that the defenses are set out in the DTPA expressly. Therefore, the Court of Appeals in Jernigan inferred a defense by saying that, well, the legislature didn't say that it was not a defense, therefore we say that it is a defense. In the first point of error on the Jernigan v. Page application for writ of error that came to this court, was writ refused, no reversible error. Although the first point of error did discuss whether or not constructive notice was a defense to a DTPA cause of action, it didn't say so in that language. It couched it in the language of estoppel. And in the language of estoppel, the Jernigans were asserting that the Court of Appeals erred as well as the trial court erred in saying that they were estopped from making their claim under the DTPA. This court has held as in July 1987 in the Home Savings v. Gura case that estoppel is not a defense to a DTPA cause of action. And essentially that is what Wise is saying, is that whether you call it constructive notice, whether you call it the recording statutes, or whether you call it estoppel, it's still, he's saying that that Mrs. Toka is estopped by virtue of the public records from making her claim under the DTPA. Further, the Court of Appeals discussed the Medallion v. Thurmar case. Now, Medallion v. Thurmar was rendered by the 14th Court of Appeals, the same Court of Appeals that rendered this decision. Again, the discussion of a DTPA defense in that case was inappropriate because the facts of that case are that a title insurance company would not close on a transaction. Medallion was asserting that Thurmar had breached its implied warranty of title. However, that transaction never closed, so there was never a breach of an implied warranty of title. But they went on and parroted the language in Jernigan v. Page and said constructive notice and actual notice bars a DTPA claim. In looking at that opinion, you can tell that the decision really turned on the fact that there was actual notice because Medallion had participated, had sat in negotiations with a representative from First City National Bank and with Medallion. First City National Bank would convey to Medallion, Medallion would convey to Thurmar. Therefore, they were on actual notice as to who actually owned the property, and there was no breach of implied warranty of title. Now, both of these cases are breach of implied warranty of title cases. But I submit to the court that even under common law, one can recover if you have actual notice or if you have constructive notice. You can still recover on your breach of implied warranty of title at common law, which should be much more narrowly construed than the much more liberal construction under the DTPA. Therefore, I don't think that you should be able to use constructive notice or actual notice, for that matter, as a bar to a DTPA cause of action based on fraud. The other two decisions which the Court of Appeals said held that constructive notice was a bar to a statutory fraud claim, they cited the Westland versus Gulf Oil case. Indeed, that case says that the recording statutes provides constructive notice of everything recorded and then operates as actual notice. But that court does not talk about barring a fraud claim. That was not a fraud claim. In fact, in that case, the court appropriately applied the recording statutes, the purposes of the recording statutes. Westland had farmed out a lease to Gulf Oil and had farmed out a lease to Superior Oil. And Gulf Oil and Superior Oil were making the claim to the same piece of property. Therefore, the recording statutes was appropriately applied because it resolved the conflict between two parties claiming the same piece of property. That's the intention of the recording statute. It's not to insulate someone who perpetrates fraud to say, I'm sorry, but you can't recover because I lied to you. You can't recover under the DTPA or for your fraud claim. NRC versus Pickard case was also cited by the 14th Court of Appeals as saying that constructive notice barred a statutory fraud claim in real estate transaction. That case, the only reason that they were discussing constructive notice or any recordation in that case was on the basis of when the statute of limitations began to run. There are a number of cases that hold that your fraud claim is barred after 4 years from the time you could have or should have discovered that fraud. So again, in Pickard, the only reason that the constructive notice and recording statutes was discussed was with regard to when the statute of limitations began to run. And the complaining party in that case did not assert their fraud claim within the 4 years of the event of recording that fraudulent event. Therefore, they could have discovered or should have discovered from that time, and they didn't assert their cause of action, and they were barred. But again, it doesn't hold that when someone commits fraud that you're barred by what's ever recorded. In the, is it appropriate, Your Honor, Justice Kilgarland, is it appropriate to go ahead and discuss the Spies-Robert opinion?
Certainly.
Okay.
I just wanted to make you aware it is still pending.
I understand.
On rehearing, but you can certainly discuss the opinion of the Court of Appeals.
Okay. In Spies-Robert versus Oberman, there was a representative of Spies-Robert who was the salesperson. And he misrepresented the monthly mortgage payments to the purchasers. They signed an earnest money contract. The purchasers had told the representative of the builder that they could only afford a certain monthly payment. He stated they can purchase this piece of property and house and to make the payment within their means. However, he had based his calculations on unimproved property. Therefore, when they moved into the house and there was improved property, the taxes were obviously escalated, and it was on a graduating, they were on an ARM mortgage, and it was on a graduating mortgage. Therefore, in subsequent years, they could not really afford the house they were in. Spies-Robert argued that, well, they saw the settlement agreement, the settlement documents, the representation of the higher mortgage payment was in that. They had a duty to read those documents. And they relied upon the Glasgow case in their argument. However, the court distinguished the Glasgow case by saying that the obligation, the purchasers were obligated under the earnest money contract from the time that they signed the earnest money contract, which was prior to any time that they knew that the mortgage payment would be increased. Therefore, in that case, it was under the 1977 DTPA version, which had language as to if one was adversely affected and it was a producing cause, you could recover under the DTPA. The court stated that by signing the earnest money contract, it could be specifically enforced or they could lose their earnest money. Therefore, they were adversely affected. It was a producing cause of their damages, and they could recover, notwithstanding the fact that they had signed documents. They had actual notice that the mortgage was different. However, they could recover because the builder's representative had special knowledge with regard to mortgage payments and figuring mortgage payments, and he made that representation to them, and because of this special knowledge, he was under a duty to tell them. The court in Spies-Robert cites cases which hold that when under particular facts and circumstances, silence can even be a false or misleading representation. And that is what happened in this case. Weiss had special knowledge. He was familiar with real estate. He was familiar with the procedures. First of all, he was aware that the building had been declared dangerous. He was familiar with the city's procedures that they would demolish the building after that. He had a duty to tell either Mrs. Toker herself or to tell the real estate agent who was representing him that this was a material fact which induced Mrs. Toker into this transaction, but for she would not have entered into had she had such information. He had a pecuniary interest in this, and that is the reason that Mr. Weiss did not disclose such information. when one has a duty to speak under certain facts and circumstances, you must speak or that silence results in fraudulent misrepresentation. And we submit to this court that he had a duty to speak. Therefore, the petitioner submits to this court that you should reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court's modified judgment in favor of Mrs. Toca because of the cases that are cited by the Court of Appeals. Simply, two of them are simply wrongly decided. The constructive notice is not a defense to a DTPA cause of action, should not be a defense. Actual notice should not be a defense, especially when compared to common law. In common law, you cannot, actual or constructive notice cannot be used to preclude a recovery. And the other two cases of Westland and Pickard simply aren't applicable and do not stand for the proposition that constructive notice is a defense to the DTPA cause of action.
Any questions?
Thank you, Kim. Thank you. We will now hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Preston Dawson will present argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, I'm Preston Dodson, appearing here for Bill Wise and Wise Developments, Inc. This case does not involve an affirmative misrepresentation. I think we have to keep that fact in mind because it is a distinguishing factor in all the cases cited in the amicus brief and in petitioner's brief. This house that burned in 1975.
Wait. Are you somehow trying to say that failure to disclose when there's a duty to disclose is not actionable under DTPA?
No, sir. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that we don't have a duty to disclose that which is already known or that which a person is charged with notice of. If there had been a fact material to this transaction that was not a public record in the real estate records, that fact being known peculiar, singularly to Mr. Wise or Wise Developments, we would have to disclose that, and had we not disclosed it, we would be liable under the Act.
What do you do with the jury finding that you intended to induce them to purchase by not disclosing? How do you get around that?
The jury found, and I'll answer that, Justice Kilgarland, the jury found that Wise had notice of the building having been declared to be a dangerous building, that he did fail to disclose it, that he intended to induce her, Ms. Toca, to purchase the property by virtue of the failure to disclose. Well, obviously, he wanted her to buy the property. I don't know that there's anything that we can do about that finding or any way that we can explain it. The fact is, the house had a sign tacked to the front of the building by the City of Houston Dangerous Building Section that said, "This is a dangerous building." Mr. Black from the Dangerous Building Section testified that the sign was there, that they periodically, and maybe as frequently as once a week, drove by to see that the signs were still posted on the buildings. The order of the building official was properly recorded in the real property records. Mr. Wise bought this property, and that was recorded in, I believe, January of 1979. The notices of the action of the city declaring this to be a dangerous building were sent to the prior owners, who were Johnny and Evans Captain. Mr. Wise was not a party to any of those notices. There's nothing in the record that indicates he was a party to those notices. He bought the property in September of 1979. When he bought the property, it was closed through Houston Title Company and Title Insurance Company of Minnesota. His title policy, as well as his deed, make no mention of the recorded order of the building official. To this point, he still has only constructive notice of the actual recorded order of the building official. That's the same exact notice that Mrs. Toka had of the order of the building official. There is nothing in the earnest money contract between Wise and Ms. Toka that represents in any way that this property is free of that lien or any other lien. It says, I will convey the property to you free and clear. And that is what the deed from Wise Developments to Ms. Toka said. That is what was insured by Title Insurance Company of Minnesota.
Are you saying he only had constructive notice that the building would be demolished?
Yes, sir.
I thought the jury found that he knew that the building was going to be demolished.
The jury found that he had notice of the order of the building official, and that's all.
You're saying the evidence is that that's only by virtue of the deed records?
Yes, sir. Exactly. Mr. Wise at no time ever spoke with Mrs. Toka or her husband, never represented anything to these people. The plaintiff attempted to have representation issues submitted to the jury, but they were rejected because there were no representations. The only basis for their judgment is a failure to disclose the existence of the recorded order of the building official. The Jernigan case, Medallion case, should protect us in that instance. I would agree with their position if Mr. Wise or someone representing Wise Development had taken an additional step and said, Ms. Toka, there is nothing of record affecting this property. But he didn't do that. And all of the cases that they cite take that additional step to make an affirmative representation contrary to the actual state of affairs.
Was this an independent real estate broker who handled the sales transaction between Wise and Toka?
That Pam Martini. She was a broker with an agent with Sappho Realty, an agent and brokerage company that Mr. and Ms. Toka had used in the past. The house was not listed for sale. Ms. Martini called Mr. Wise, apparently traced him down in some manner, because maybe through the deed records or whatever, to see if he would sell the property to Ms. Toka. The NRC versus Pickard case doesn't turn simply on the statute of limitations. There were two significant issues in that case. One issue was the failure to disclose the existence of the recorded easement. The court said the recording statute protects you. You're not liable for failure to disclose that recorded instrument. Different story as to the elevation of the lot. Its suitability for building purposes. That is not something that is of record and readily apparent. But the existence of the easement, as in this case, the existence of the recorded order of the building official, was of record. They're charged with notice, just the same as Wise and Wise Developments is charged with notice. There was, again, no misrepresentation contrary to that, only a failure to disclose. This judgment isn't based on a breach of warranty. It's based on failure to disclose, and that being a misrepresentation. The courts have held, in the cases we cited in our brief, so indicate, you're not obligated to disclose that which the other party is charged with notice of. The issue of additional damages was not presented to the jury.
Now wait, you say you've added an additional provision to 1746B23. That statute says a failure to disclose information concerning goods or services which was known at the time of the transaction, if such failure to disclose such information was intended to induce the consumer into a transaction into which the consumer would not have entered had the information been disclosed. Don't you have jury findings there that's sufficient to cover all of that?
Yes, sir. We have a jury finding on each one of those issues. But this court in Jernigan v. Page rejected...
No, this court only gave an NRE to Jernigan v. Page.
Yes, sir. That's
and that language on page 162 of the Court of Appeals opinion is dicta, is it not? What that case really turned on was there was no evidence of a finding of agency there against the Pages, and there was no conduct alleged against the Pages themselves. That was the holding in the case, and the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals threw that language in as dicta, did it not?
In general terms, it is, I suspect, dicta. The allegations were misrepresentation as well, failure to disclose in Jernigan v. Page. And the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi did indeed say the recording statute is a defense. If the recording statute isn't a defense, when you don't have an affirmative misrepresentation, I mean a statement that says, buyer, it's different from what, I mean, that there's nothing of record, it's different, then that recording statute means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. It puts a seller, a real estate, or anything else in the posture of reading the mind of the buyer to determine what is material to that buyer. There's absolutely, absolutely no way that a party transacting a sale could protect oneself in that instance.
Just to make the point clear, I think Mr. Bailey mentioned it earlier, alluded to it rather, you're not contending that the recording statutes themselves set out within their language the fact that they are a defense, that it's a, that is a common law defense based on the recording statutes, is that?
No, I'm not saying the recording statute itself provides it is a defense. It is, I think, not a common law defense, but a statutory, an act since 1879 that has provided this protection to sellers of real estate, to parties transacting in real estate.
But the protection comes through court through a court opinion, does it not? Not from the statutes themselves, but based upon the fact that you must record a real estate transaction if you want to be protected. The court has, through its role in the common law, has said that will be a defense to any action based upon title.
I don't believe we had that defense in common law prior to 1879. I may be wrong, but I don't believe we had it. I haven't seen the cases that say we did. The courts have consistently followed that statute, except in those cases where there is an additional action by one party to the transaction that should grant relief. NRC versus Pickering is an example. Westland Oil, they're all charged with notice of what is there. The